Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. Welcome back to another episode of Peter's Proffer here in the courtroom of current events. And today we are tackling another legal documentary. We get all sorts of comments and texts and emails about, you know, what's real and what's not about these shows and movies and documentaries that talk about the legal process or someone getting arrested or sued or something like that. And today we decided to try something a little bit different. We decided to bring someone on the show that texted and asked me and my dad a bunch of legal questions about the Jeffrey Epstein Filthy Rich Netflix documentary. That person happens to be my sister, Gina. She's going to come on the show today and ask us actually these questions that she texted with us so we can talk through some of the answers together, and you can get kind of a perspective of someone who's not a lawyer, a perspective of someone who asks us these questions on a regular basis. You probably have some of the same questions at home that we could never come up with as lawyers. So it'll be fun. It'll be a little bit different today. Hopefully you enjoy this topic and this format, because we may be doing it again in the future. If you have any topics you want to hear us talk about, you can hit us up on social media. At Tragos Law is our handle, or you can send me an email, petertragos@greeklaw.com. All right, so we're here with my sister Gina, I almost said Tragos, Meisenhelder, and my dad, because a couple weeks ago Gina started texting us about this Jeffrey Epstein documentary on Netflix called Filthy Rich, said she had a bunch of questions, she didn't know if they were stupid questions for people that aren't lawyers. We ended up coming up with the idea to just do a podcast on them, answering the questions. We haven't answered any of her questions, so she's been held in suspense for weeks. So now we have all the questions here to kind of go through. But before we go through the questions, Dad, we'll start with you. What are some of your overarching themes and what you felt or thought about the documentary as a whole?
Well, when any producer or director, they get together and they've got to decide, what's our theme going to be? In this case, it's obviously it was a victim-centered theme. It really turned out to be therapy for the victim. The victims got to speak what they wanted to say, and they did a majority of what was going on, as opposed to a search for individual facts or a search for the legal parameters of what happened.
Well, I think that's the point. If you're going to, first of all, when they start the documentary, they don't know probably which way it's going to go. They're just interviewing these victims. But if you get too literal and what the court cases did all right, nobody's going to watch that. I think they did a good job personally, not from the law side because I'm not a lawyer, but I think they did a good job of capturing your attention and make it, well, for me at least, making you want to see more and see how this plays out and what happens, because I didn't even know who Epstein was before all of these things came out.
So maybe, and that might have something to do with it, but me and Dad talked about it a little bit, and neither of us, I think, particularly enjoyed the documentary, and I don't think it's because it didn't get into the legal process enough. So we have Gina to thank that we had to watch this, but I just thought that it was, first off, it was called Filthy Rich, so I thought they were going to focus a lot more on the fact about how wealthy defendants with big-time, big-shot criminal defense lawyers get better deals. And we're going to talk about the plea deal and stuff like that through the questions, but I just felt like it was kind of a weird documentary. I felt like overall the victims were not incredibly credible throughout it. I felt horrible for them. There was so much smoke that there was obviously fire. Jeffrey Epstein was obviously a creep, and a lot of the, you know, rich and famous people that were with him, I'm sure, partook in some of this debauchery. But I just felt like it was a really weird setup to the documentary. I almost felt like the one main girl, Roberts, I think was her last name, I feel like if she would have just, she was seemed very credible to me, if she would have just kind of gone through her story with him every day for years and years, and then she finally escaped and got married to somebody else, and then at the very end, it would have been powerful if you had like 50 other girls be like, I was also, you know, abused by Jeffrey Epstein, I was also abused by Jeff, I was also, but I think having so many girls with the story of, hey, you want to get make some money and massage an old guy? Sure, I'll go do that. That sounds like fun. And then they keep coming back and keep coming back. It's just kind of a weird scenario that was set up, which I'm sure he targeted these women that would be less credible purposefully. But I don't know. It wasn't my favorite documentary like this when compared to some of the serial killer ones, like what's the guy that we did before?
Ted Bundy.
Yeah, Ted Bundy, the Making a Murderer one. Those were much more interesting to me and much better to me as far as a viewing experience goes.
Well, those are more about the murders and not the rapes. And I think this, the biggest thing was because of the Me Too movement. That's the only reason he came back around.
Yeah,
so that's why they had to focus on all the girls. If it was just one at the beginning, you're like, what kind of a case is this? Why
and
am
then
I going to
boom,
keep...
at the end, they drop the hammer with 50 other girls. Yeah, I guess that's
true. If there
true,
was only one girl like accusing this rich guy, then yeah, obviously.
But I already knew, as I'm sure, Dad, you knew most of this Jeffrey Epstein story, especially since so much of it happened in Florida. What, did you already know about all this before the documentary?
Oh, yes. I knew about it. I followed because I knew a lot of the players personally. I knew the state attorney.
Your boy Roy Black.
I know Roy Black. He's a friend. I know Jack Goldberg, who represented Epstein. He's a friend.
Yeah.
So I followed it because I knew these people.
Dershowitz, who's in every single defense team and you know every chance he gets to jump in there, whatever. It was cool. I mean, it was definitely a heavy hitters row of defense attorneys, which most of these rich and famous people do, and we'll talk about how that can affect plea deals. So Gina sent some of the questions in, so we kind of broke them down into sections. And the first section is just kind of the conduct of prosecutors and how criminal cases go generally. So why don't you go ahead and start with your first question?
Okay, so is it normal for lawyers in the state attorney's office to have all of the meetings that these particular lawyers had outside of their office?
All right. Well, first, let's get the terminology straight. We have a state attorney's office and we have a U.S. attorney's office. When they talked about Acosta during this, that's the U.S. attorney. Barry Krischer, that's the state attorney.
Right. So there was dealings with both the state attorney in this case and the U.S. attorney in this case with Epstein and his lawyers.
Right. But the meetings outside the office, that was Acosta, the U.S. attorney, that happened in the Marriott Hotel.
And some emails that she can talk about with the assistant U.S. attorney. That all of this was mostly federal, what you're talking about when they're dealing with this plea deal. So
right.
The question, you know, more pointed to this documentary is it normal for assistant U.S. attorneys or the U.S. attorney to have meetings outside the office?
Well, I used to be an assistant U.S. attorney.
Chief
of the criminal division for the U.S. attorney's office. I've never seen this happen. You wouldn't want this to happen because you don't know who's recording it. You don't know who's listening in. There's no security in that situation. So it's highly unusual for something like this to happen.
And when we say meetings outside the office, we're friends with a lot of state attorneys or U.S. attorneys, so we'll see them. Like the old one used to go to church with Pete, one of the old chief assistants used to go to church with Pete. He would see him every Sunday at church, talk to him. We're not talking about saying hi, being friends, having dinner, whatever. You're talking specifically having plea negotiations and doing work on a case.
You don't accidentally bump into people in a room in a Marriott.
Right, exactly.
You're there for a purpose.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. It's not like they were just having dinner together. There's nothing wrong with being friends, even with judges, whatever. But doing actual legal work like this in a private office that's not the U.S. Attorney's office is kind of weird because you have tons of meetings at the U.S. Attorney. They never even come to your office, right, for the most part.
Well, you always go to the prosecutor's office.
You always go to the U.S. Attorney's office, or almost always, to do this type of work that you're talking about.
So that's the first sketchy thing that was happening.
Yeah.
That was why I asked that question. So then giving out the home email address, directly to Epstein, right?
That one I didn't understand who actually gave them the email address.
I thought the assistant U.S. attorney, the female one like crying for the victims and all that stuff, she gave it out to the lawyer, I thought.
That would surprise me because U.S. attorney's offices rarely even disclose who the witnesses are unless someone is indicted and going to trial. So, again, that's highly unusual if that was her. I didn't think that was very clear how they got it, whether they got it through a private investigator finding it. But if the U.S. attorney's office gave the email addresses out, highly unusual
fact. Yeah, except that I do, they wouldn't because they're the government, so it's different than when we talk about civil cases. But I have before, actually, in a case just recently, I gave my Gmail email address to an opposing counsel because our firewall was, like, blocking her emails to us. but Gmail, it got through, and that's how we were able to communicate, is using my Gmail, and then I'd have to copy my work email. I understand that's totally different when you're dealing with government workers, but that's the only thing I can think of, is that it wasn't getting through to her government email. Maybe she gave him her Gmail address, but in reality, they don't care. I was trying to get an offer, so I cared. Okay. I wanted to hear what the offer was, so I gave my Gmail address. Well, it's not the same thing.
Understand, though, this was a home email as opposed to her government email.
Gmail is a home email.
But the government email is subject to public records. The home email is not.
Exactly, which is a huge difference. Right.
Mark number two.
Right, exactly.
For sketchiness. Yeah, and I think when it popped up on the screen, it said, like, why don't you just email me at home? My email address is. So it was like a...
Yeah, it definitely seemed like it was from the lawyer, the female lawyer.
So, thoughts on the deal that was done kind of under the table without the victims or their lawyers having any knowledge? Because I think it talked about how he was outside the courthouse and they were saying Epstein is going in to sign something and everybody was kind of following him in and he signed and left.
That's a huge topic because that deals with a lot of areas about what happened here. Again, talking about the highly unusual. Initially, the state attorney's office starts an investigation. They're real hot on it. Then they cool down. The FBI comes in. The U.S. attorney takes over. The state attorney washes their hands of the investigation.
Well, the FBI took over because of the local police department pushed the case to the FBI when the state attorney's office was not pursuing charges.
Right, when they cooled down on the chief of
the police. The police chief, yeah.
They cooled down on it. He felt they cooled down, so then he got to the FBI. FBI took it over, so then the U.S. attorney becomes the primary investigative agency with the FBI on the case. Then, all of a sudden, which again, later on we talk about what a federal judge thought of this, but then all of a sudden, we've got a situation where a deal comes up like that, but the deal involves a plea to a state charge, not a federal charge. He goes into state custody. It's a deal that requires him to be 18 months in a local jail, where he gets different food than everybody else.
Well, but
it was all part of the deal. And let's finish. One of the worst parts of the deal is the fact that everybody got immunity, including the co-conspirators.
But my question is, how were the victims and their lawyers not even notified? Isn't that illegal?
Absolutely. And we'll hear what a federal judge has to say about it later on in the podcast.
So we'll pause for a second here because I think it's a really important point that you brought up, Dad, that this is the federal prosecutor making a deal to a state crime with state punishments, okay? And that's a huge deal. That's a huge topic. We've done a podcast on it, what the difference is between federal and state crimes. We've done a podcast on plea deals that really gets into all the nitty-gritty and dives deep into all these topics that we're talking about. We're going to kind of focus on the Epstein plea deal specifically. But I know Gina has some more follow-up questions that have to do with the plea deals. So what else do you want to know specifically about how the plea deal process works?
So was his work release from prison common, or did he get special treatment? And did you think that he knew the right people? And is work release even a part of a plea deal in the first place?
Because of the crimes he was charged with, because of the sentence he got, he was eligible for work release. So he did the proper applications, and he got work release. He was allowed to go to his office 12 hours a day. He had a private deputy sheriff that cost him $128,000 that actually accompanied him. He apparently had women brought into his office
while he was on work release.
Those are things that don't normally happen on work release.
Right, and the work release part of this case and part of his sentence is not something that's part of the plea deal. Work release is something that happens after you take a plea deal, after you get sentenced, and that's why it's such a big deal about what you get charged with, what you plea to, what your conviction actually states and shows, because there are only certain charges and certain crimes that even make you eligible for work release. And you have to actually qualify for that. There's also something called house arrest where you can actually do your time at your house with an ankle monitor, things like that. And Dad, we've actually had that happen in some of our cases where we've gone to trial, lost, our client got sentenced to jail time, we got him out, and he was on house arrest and could do a lot of things that most people that go to jail can't, right? So, I mean, it can happen in a case, but it's something that you have to actually apply for and qualify for after you're convicted.
Right, because the sheriff controls the work release program. So the sheriff has to be the one that gives you permission to do that. Understand, the sheriff, though, in this case, because he was interviewed,
right,
had nothing to do. He was told the guy gets 18 months, he serves in the county jail. Normally, you don't serve county jail time if your sentence is more than a year and a day. So they made an exception for him by order of the state attorney, because the state attorney had to actually give this deal because the U.S. attorney didn't have jurisdiction to charge him with a state crime.
So I think to answer the question fully, the work release portion might not have been special treatment because he did have to qualify for it, but the specifics of the work release and where he did his jail time and how he did his jail time and how none of the things he was doing was violating his sentence or his work release, that all was probably special treatment. And the fact that the U.S. attorney strong-armed basically the state attorney, that might not have been special treatment. I'm sure that happens, you know, every so often where the U.S. attorney says, hey, state attorney, do this.
Well, didn't he get 12 hours? What's a normal work release? Isn't that 8 hours for work?
It's sometimes, but actually sometimes if you have a job and the job says it's a 12-hour job, they'll let you do a 12-hour job.
6 days
did
a week.
Did he have a job?
But understand, his 12 hours was working for himself.
No, he was running basically his Ponzi scheme, right?
Yeah, he wasn't out there.
It's not easy to run a good, well-oiled Ponzi scheme, okay? You need 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. Dad, what are your thoughts generally on Alex Acosta?
Well, I tell you, I had a pretty high opinion of him when he was the U.S. attorney. Seemed like a decent guy, seemed like honest, and he seemed very straightforward. I don't understand this deal. I mean, I wasn't there. I didn't talk to him. I don't blame the defense lawyers, because defense lawyers are supposed to get the best deal they possibly can. But on the other hand, the prosecutor, he had, from if you can believe the press, a 53-page indictment ready to go on this guy. And he just shelved the 53-page indictment and let the state attorney's office charge him with the solicitation of a minor and walk away from it. And I just can't understand that. It's hard for me to explain it.
One of my favorite quotes in the entire documentary was when he was being questioned when he was getting appointed to as the Secretary of Labor or whatever by Trump. And they asked, was this plea deal from Jeffrey Epstein a consensus decision in your office? And his answer after a long pause was, it was a broadly held decision.
Right, and
which is a no, it's not a consensus.
Well, but you know, though, that's not unusual. The U.S. attorney has to make decisions sometimes that maybe is unpopular with the staff. But the
point is, this was one of them.
Right.
And I think that just makes him look even worse, that it's clear that this was a decision that plenty of his staff or his other attorneys didn't agree with.
But understand, he also took this decision up. And it went to the assistant attorney general.
So that's the next question. So they mentioned that line of who actually approves a plea deal like this, a federal plea deal like this. How high does it actually go? And is it different depending on the case?
Well, first off, I think you need to determine that it doesn't have to go as this one went.
Okay, so it does. So it can just stop. I mean, because I've always been under the impression that the state attorney in that office is where the buck stops.
The U.S. attorney.
Same thing with the U.S. attorney is where the buck stops. But this one went up. Why did it go up?
There are certain protocols.
The U.S. attorney is higher than the state attorney, yes, for all intents and purposes, but they're not the same line. The state attorney is the top dog in his office. There's nobody above him in his office. He is the federal or the state equivalent to a U.S. attorney. So they're equals technically, but I think most people would say a U.S. attorney has more power because they usually have a bigger jurisdiction than the state attorney, and federal crimes are usually more serious. Mm-hmm. And like in this case, sometimes the U.S. attorney can pass something down to the state attorney. It doesn't happen opposite. The state attorney can't force the U.S. attorney to do anything.
And the U.S. attorney can't force the state attorney.
Literally speaking, they can't, but it happened in this case. So.
Right, it happened in this case, but normally it's a matter of cooperation, not an order.
Right,
and
I get it.
And so he cooperated. The state attorney and the U.S. attorney kind of cooperated on this deal. But the going up, that's unusual unless it's a specific kind of crime. In this case, my guess is high profile is something that does go up the chain sometimes. And in this case, I think to cover his butt, I think that's what he did. He went to the assistant attorney general in charge of the criminal division and apparently the attorney general, and they all approved it.
Yeah, I mean, and that is kind of crazy to me how high it went up and how all those people approved it theoretically, but it's all coming back down on Acosta now. Do you think, and again, we go into this a lot more in our plea deal, do you think that credibility of these victims or, you know, the circumstances of what happened? Do you think all that came into play, or do you think it was purely just he had enough money, he had enough, I don't know, blackmail on important people, he had enough people making phone calls to him for on his behalf to the U.S. attorney? What do you think went into his decision-making, Acosta's decision-making on the plea deal?
Well, first off, if you have maybe one victim or two victims, that individual victim's credibility
is
plays
really
a big, big part. If you have 30 victims or 10 victims all saying the same thing, then the individual victim's credibility doesn't become as important
right.
as it would have been.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a whole bunch of victims here. However, one of his lawyers was Ken Starr, for example. Well, you know Ken Starr can pick up the phone and call the attorney general up and talk to the attorney general about a case.
Right.
So I think that the influence had something to do with this. And it apparently, Mr. Acosta wanted to go to higher office. I mean, he became a cabinet member later. So if all these people are putting pressure on him,
pressures he had,
maybe that came into it. It's just hard to believe that a 53-page indictment with this many victims just disappeared.
Well, and my question is, so then he stepped down from his
this
position.
Was recently. This
yes.
is way later.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. So I don't know if I'm jumping ahead, but he stepped down because he said that it wasn't handled. Right? Didn't he say it wasn't
He said
handled?
He didn't want this administration to get the blowback, meaning the Trump administration, to get the blowback from the Epstein case with his name attached to it. And he knows that right now with his position, that's what's going to happen. He still has not ever backed off his decision.
But if he didn't do anything wrong, would he have stepped down, do you think?
Yeah, I think legitimately he didn't want the blowback to come on his current position. And I'm sure there was a lot of pressure for him to step down from other people as well.
Also, keep in mind that one of the things he said was that the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York had more information. Well, what that really means is that there wasn't a proper investigation done in Miami, because
right.
all of that material was available to Miami and they didn't investigate it.
Okay. So is it common and or legal to give it an immunity deal like the one that Epstein got for himself, for him and any named or unnamed co-conspirators?
That is the real, to me,
the craziest
that's
part.
The craziest
Absolute
part of this plea deal.
Craziest
I
part.
Have
well,
never
say,
in
this
my life,
was involved,
I've been practicing, for 40 years, a whole bunch of that as a state prosecutor and a federal prosecutor. I've never seen a plea where named and unnamed co-conspirators got immunity.
Now, named, yes.
Named or Epstein himself, who works a deal, got immunity. But unnamed co-conspirators, I mean, people that are sitting out there. And I tell you what else is kind of surprising. Epstein, from what you hear about his personality, why did he care about anybody else? Why did he care about the unnamed
co-conspirators? Well, these are probably the people that were calling on his
yeah.
behalf to Acosta and putting pressure on to get him the deal.
I don't know.
I mean,
from an outside perspective, that's what it seems like, for sure.
Well, that's the problem with this case, is it's so abnormal that you don't have to, you lawyer or not, you can be like, this just seems really weird. Because the fact that you can have something, I mean, again, if we want to really get into the nitty-gritty, how would you ever prove you're an unnamed co-conspirator? That just kind of leaves the power in Epstein's hand to
well,
be
yeah,
like,
if it ever comes out
yeah.
in the future.
Well, what I'm saying is Epstein can be like, he's one of my unnamed. He's not one of my unnamed.
Well, what it really comes down to, though, if you go as a practical matter, say Joe Smith, they want to charge him. Well, they can't charge him as a conspirator with Epstein because all unnamed co-conspirators got immunity.
Because he's a co-conspirator.
Right.
All right, Dad. So earlier you mentioned that a federal judge agreed with Gina, or with the answer that you gave Gina, about whether or not the rights of the victims were violated, or whether it was legal to do this plea deal in the shadows without the victims or their lawyers understanding or knowing what's going on. And a federal judge determined that Epstein and federal prosecutors entered into a conspiracy to violate the victims' rights. That's crazy to me. What does that actually mean practically, and how does it affect the case?
Well, for one of the first times in history, probably, victims filed a motion with the court for the court to dismiss an immunity agreement, because that agreement was done without the victim's input, which the Victims' Rights Act says has to happen, or they have a right to be involved in the agreement.
They don't get to determine punishment, but they have to be involved in the process.
They got to be invited
right.
to the table. Right. They don't have to make. They can't make the decision, but they've
right.
got to be invited. In this case, the judge agreed that the U.S. Attorney's Office conspired, as you said, with the defense lawyer,
which is crazy as well.
And he threw out the immunity deal. Now, understand this immunity deal, one of the reasons that it probably went to the assistant attorney general is because an immunity deal that's signed in Miami is only good in Miami. There are 94 federal districts. It's not good in New York unless it's approved by the Department of Justice of Washington, which would be the assistant attorney general. So they had a plea deal that was good all over the country for this immunity. Once it was thrown out, that just threw the doors open now for everybody to file charges. And it really was a very harsh decision by Judge Mara in 2017 against the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Okay, so let's kind of take it step by step. What does the judge's decision do for the criminal cases of all of Epstein himself and all the named and unnamed co-conspirators?
It means they can be investigated and indicted by any federal jurisdiction in the country now.
Including Epstein?
Including Epstein.
So it wasn't just the immunity agreement, it was the plea deal altogether?
No, not the state plea deal. The state plea deal still worked out. He got his 18 months. That's over.
But he can still be charged with federal charges,
right?
Even Epstein himself.
Correct.
Okay, so it opens everything up to that. Number two, how does it affect the civil cases?
It really doesn't have an impact on the civil cases because, again, that's a different arena. They're suing basically for money because they can't put anybody in jail. Mm-hmm. So it has no impact on the civil cases.
Okay, and then what happens to the named conspirator, the named co-conspirators in the immunity agreement? Are they like basically automatic? They're going to get sued now. They're going to get investigated. They're going to get arrested? Because, I mean, they were literally named as co-conspirators in his crime.
They could have always been sued, but now they can actually be charged with crimes and be arrested.
I have a question. So when they made that plea deal, did they actually admit, they actually like gave information to get that immunity deal that now could be used against them?
No. Nobody had to give any information in that plea deal.
I guess Epstein just could list the names of people he wanted in the immunity agreement. That's what it sounded like happened. They're like, all right, who do you want in here? And he sent a list of 20 names, and they put all the names in there without having to get any other
information. And the list doesn't have to be complete. It could be unnamed as well.
Right. So the last kind of part dealing with victims and their rights, Florida not too long ago had a victims rights amendment coming down the pipeline. We did a podcast on it. It was episode 52. We referenced one earlier, the one on plea deals, which was episode 70. But in that victims rights amendment, what do you think the correlation is with this case and cases like this? Do you think that had an effect on why Florida was amending the victims rights throughout the criminal process?
It had an effect on the, you know, why people would vote for victims' rights, because, you know, we see victims being victimized like this. All these protections about the victims having to be consulted, they were already in the statutes. They're already in the Federal Victims' Rights Act, and now we have a constitutional amendment in Florida all protecting victims from what went on here.
Even though we may not have agreed with how far the amendment went with almost giving victims too much power over what the sentence would actually be, even though they don't have experience dealing with that like lawyers and judges do, it is important, obviously, to have these protections in place so that this type of plea deal can't happen.
Well, it's important to have a transparent process. It's important for everybody to know what's going on so that things can't happen in secret. Because when things happen in secret, you get what happened here in the Epstein case.
Mm-hmm. And I also thought it was crazy how some of the minors, some of the victims who were minors, their names got released. Because, I mean, that's protected to the umpteen degree usually. But in this case, I mean, even their names weren't protected.
Well, you have, for instance, obviously Epstein knew who they were.
Mm-hmm.
He told his lawyers. His lawyers hired private investigators. The private investigators used to follow the victims, used to follow a lot of people in order to try to intimidate them. So, you know, the releasing of their names is all part of the intimidation and control that Epstein was famous for.
All right, so that's a lot of what we have on just kind of the criminal prosecution and what happens in these plea deals and what the victims' rights are. We're going to move into some, just a few quick general lightning round type questions.
Okay, so did you hear about the case while it was going on, and do you have any thoughts that were cleared up or blurred by this documentary?
I think the documentary did not
Well, you knew about this case prior.
Right. Yeah. So I don't think they did a really good job on the process, the criminal process and what happened. Mm-hmm. They did a very good job of presenting the victims and the victims' stories. But again, it was almost like they blamed the criminal defense lawyers for doing a good job for their client, and that's what they're supposed to do. It's the prosecutor.
I didn't feel like that at all. I don't feel like anybody even said anything about the defense attorneys except for Dershowitz, which we'll get to later. But I don't feel like they said anything about the defense attorneys. And to answer this question from my perspective, yes, I knew about it. I knew it was going on. The one and only thing that was cleared up to me in this doc is I was not aware of that federal judge's ruling that the defense attorneys and the U.S. attorney were co-conspirators in violating the victim's rights. I had never heard of that
order. There's one thing I did learn. He served his 18 months in a county jail. I didn't know he served his 18 months in a state facility. Mm-hmm. I thought he served his 18 months in a federal facility because that was the investigation that was going on.
Yeah, well, I only knew about the work release stuff. So I assumed it was a local jail, because how else would you get that work release?
Feds have work release.
But yeah, but don't they have to have a prison close to where he works in order to do that?
Well, they have one in Miami.
Oh, okay.
So they could have been a federal work release. They have a detention center in Miami.
But Miami wasn't his primary residence, was it?
The Virgin Islands were technically his primary residence.
But that's not where he did his work release.
Yeah. Exactly. He wished. Okay. What's next?
So, what are your thoughts on his girlfriend and her role in these crimes? Because a lot of the victims specifically named her as being part of these sexual abuses. So, was she a victim, a co-conspirator, and why has she not been prosecuted or charged?
She is not the only one. She might have been a primary procurer of the girls. There are five or six other girls that procured a bunch of other girls.
Not procured.
Actually, there was at least one other girl that I know admitted participating in what was going on.
Why is she not?
I don't know. I don't know why. I understand some of the arguments.
Like, they know who she is.
I understand some of the arguments on some of the girls, because these girls were victims as mm-hmm. well as the procurers. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of sympathy there because, you know, these girls were preyed upon by him. Her, I don't understand why she hasn't been charged. That's a very good question, and I even went online to try to see if I can figure out something. There's no logic, no explanation for why she hasn't been charged.
Hmm.
Gugliani, I think that's her name, Gugliani.
No, it was something
else.
Yeah,
weird. Like her long name
Gugliani,
something.
Yeah.
It wasn't Gugliani. It was like Gillian or something. No. I can't remember what it was.
So then, he started out as a sketchy dude anyways, falsifying his degree to get his first job as the professor. Is that against the law? Is it a crime to lie on your resume and then get a job and practice that area that you're not qualified for?
It can be considered fraudulent for him to lie on his application. If he did that, and we're presuming he did since he was a teacher and didn't have a college degree, but yes, it could be fraudulent to do that.
I think that's kind of a gray area. I don't think it's always a crime to lie on your resume. I think it absolutely is for certain jobs. If it's a government job,
you have to have credentials.
If it's a lawyer, you know, if you're lying about your law degree, then you're practicing law without a license. But I don't know if it's illegal to say I worked at Barnes & Noble when I'm trying to get a job at Walmart if you didn't actually work. Don't get prosecuted.
No, they don't get prosecuted for it, but it's fraudulent to apply for a job that requires a college degree.
Right.
You say you have a college degree, so you are collecting money from this company or this school based on a fraudulent representation.
Sure, but we've seen this happen a lot, and rarely gets prosecuted. But technically, I guess
they could have caught him way back when.
Yeah, exactly. If only we cared about small crimes like this.
Yeah, exactly. So if you own an island, what kind of laws are enforced on that island?
It's the jurisdiction in which the island is located. I don't remember them really saying it, but I think the presumption was this was part of the Virgin Islands.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it was a United States territory. So the federal laws of the United States would apply on the island.
Yeah, you can't actually own an island outright, you know, for the most part, and like live on it.
Different
it's always under some sort of control.
Okay, so they would be under U.S. law.
Right, the Virgin Islands, right.
Okay.
Correct.
It would be just like committing a crime on any other Virgin Island.
Okay. And doesn't rape have a statute of limitations? SVU fan right here.
Only in some jurisdictions. I do not know if it has a statute of limitations in, like, for instance, some jurisdictions have done away with statute of limitations on sexual offenses. So I can't tell you whether under the specific statute they were charging that it had a statute of limitations. But again, there are some areas that do not have a statute of limitations with things like rape and murder.
You're saying area as in area?
Geographic areas, right.
Now there are accusations against Dershowitz about rape, so there's competing slander complaints. Why would they have two competing complaints that are the same?
Well, Dershowitz is suing the young lady because she accused him of raping her, and the young lady is suing him because she said that she's a total liar and a fraud.
Right.
So they're suing each other.
So, and we did a podcast on slander that you can go back and listen to for the specific elements of it, but truth is an affirmative defense, meaning if what you're saying is true, then you can't be guilty or you can't lose a slander complaint. Like what they're both saying, but they're both saying totally opposite things. So one of them's telling the truth, one of them's lying, one of them is going to lose.
How do you navigate that?
Yeah, well, it's going to be almost impossible in a he said, she said situation, unless obviously if he gets convicted of it, then she can use that as proof that he did in fact rape her. I thought it was really interesting and weird how certain people were called out as being rapists and saying they did do things while it was like very clear. People like Chris Tucker, they said, yeah, he was there, but nothing weird happened while Chris Tucker
that
was on the island.
Trip. Yeah, no, that whole that, trip. Yeah,
and Bill Clinton,
Bill
too.
Clinton was there, but no accusations of rape.
He has accusations from the pool guy.
But
maybe not full.
I thought that was Prince Albert. No, that was Prince Albert, who the pool guy said he was rubbing up against the 17-year-old girl who was topless.
Prince Andrew.
Whatever. And he has a condition where he doesn't sweat, so it couldn't have possibly been. But anyways, so, and then Trump. I mean, I thought this was the perfect opportunity for whoever was making this to be like, yes, Trump is also a rapist, and they didn't say he raped anybody. So, I mean, it was very interesting, and I'd be a little nervous if I was Dershowitz that he's the only defense lawyer that she said, you know, is committed rape and that he was been on the island and all that stuff. I mean, that was really weird and that would really suck.
And you know, another thing to talk about, you know, things that were unusual is when he finished his 18 months, he went right back into society. They accepted him in New York.
Yeah. Nobody blackballed him.
He went to all the big parties. He had a big party in 2010 when his probation was over. Woody Allen was there. Prince Andrew was there. Everybody's having a great time.
Well, Dad, you asked the question earlier. I mean, Jeffrey Epstein only cared about himself. Why did he put all these people's names in the immunity agreement? Well, maybe that was another reason. It's because he knew he was going to get out in 18 months, and he wanted his life to go back to normal. So he protected all these people, and now he has it over them forever that he protected them.
It's amazing that his life went back to normal.
Oh, and that's the other thing. Yeah, all the video cameras and all of his properties. I bet he sent out a few letters and a few videos to get everybody to be friends with him again.
Exactly.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the second, or his final case, we'll call it, before he committed suicide in prison. What happened in that case? What led to him being imprisoned? You can talk about the bail hearing if you want. We did a whole podcast on bail and bonds and how that process works if you want to go back and listen to that podcast. But what specifically about the last case do you want to talk about?
If he committed suicide. All right.
Well, okay, obviously he got indicted. And he apparently was going to leave because he had diamonds and false passports in his safe.
He had a getaway plan.
Yeah, the agents raided his $77 million townhouse in New York and grabbed all these pornographic, child pornography, all this stuff out of his house. And so the bail hearing, they could try to get him out, and he tried to, you know, he put hundreds of millions of dollars for bail. Judge didn't let him out once they found out he could flee because, frankly, here's a guy that could certainly flee. So he didn't get out. He knew he was never going to see the light of day again. The charges, they charged him with a 2-count indictment that could put him in prison for 45 years. So he's sitting in a place called the Tombs, which is the nickname for the federal detention facility in New York. And, you know, his life was over and he knew it.
Okay, so he supposedly commits suicide.
What, 2 days before that, he changed his will.
Correct.
And he's transferred all of his money into an offshore account.
$577 million into a trust in the Virgin Islands.
Right, and we'll get to that. But real quick, how common is it for someone to commit suicide in prison?
Very rare. And again, here's another set of strange circumstances surrounding this case. He is in a cell. He apparently tries to commit suicide, fails, they put him into a suicide watch. They take him off the suicide watch, put him in a cell with another prisoner. They take that other prisoner out. He's alone in his cell. He's supposed to be checked every 30 minutes. The guards falsify their records that they were checking him every 33 minutes. He hangs himself, which, again, suspicious circumstances. And then eventually the guards get charged with falsifying records. The autopsies, which were multiple, say that the way the bones were broken in the neck couldn't have happened the way they say it happened. So there's going to always be kind of a conspiracy theory mystery surrounding his death.
Especially with all the people that probably wanted him dead, all the important, rich, famous, mm-hmm. whatever people that wanted him dead. I mean, that just throws all sorts of shade on him committing suicide. Not to mention, it's not the easiest thing in the world to commit suicide in prison. Like, they realize people's lives are over. They realize a lot of people are going to want to kill themselves. They have the ward where they send everybody that says they're even thinking about committing suicide, where they're wearing paper clothes and they're just in a four-wall thing where there's nothing there.
Have you ever, did you come with me when I visited my clients and were on that suicide watch?
Yeah, they're literally screaming at the top of their lungs. It's like, we had a guy one time that was trying to get attention, I think, from some of the guards saying he wanted to commit suicide because he actually didn't. And every time he did it, he like regretted it immediately because he's freezing wearing paper clothing and he's in with these like people just screaming at the top of their lungs all day, every day. And he's like, why did I do this? But that's neither here nor there. So they do have protocols that should prevent people from being able to kill themselves in prison, because it's not a shocker that someone that's looking at the rest of their life in prison might want to kill themselves. So that is just another thing that adds a shady level to his suicide. Let me just get through this last part. So abatement. We did a whole podcast on abatement. And they mentioned it briefly in the documentary, Dad, but how does his death in prison affect his criminal case?
Well, the criminal case is over. He's died. But the unusual thing that happened was this federal judge, before the judge dismissed the case, let all the victims come into court and have their say. And so many of the victims said it was like a cleansing or a relief that someone high up, someone important, actually listened to them and listened to their story.
I was just going to ask about his death. And you said he tried to commit suicide once. Didn't he say that his cellmate tried to kill him?
That's what he said. The cellmate denies it, but they put him in a suicide watch right after that.
And then he dies, so I'm just saying.
Yeah.
So real quick, let's just talk about how his death affects the civil cases. We already talked about him moving the $570 million over to the Virgin Islands. How does that affect the civil case and people that are still suing him trying to get that money? Is the civil case over if you die?
No. They sue the estate.
You can continue as if the person is still alive when you go after their estate. The only thing you don't have is obviously them to question on the stand.
I've read a lot of comments, and we're, none of us here are probate lawyers, that he made it more difficult to collect
from him
because he put it in a trust in the Virgin Islands. I don't know why that makes it more difficult, but apparently it does.
Does he have children?
I have no idea, but I know he has a brother who I think is the one making decisions for the estate because he was in the documentary. But what I don't understand is it was him personally. So most of the time we're suing insurance companies or people that own businesses and they can, you know, protect their assets. But when you sue somebody personally, they can't really protect their assets as well. So putting it all in the Virgin Islands, I don't know the rules of the Virgin Islands, but I know when somebody has money, you can sue them for that money. And when it's just the estate, you still go after the estate as if the person's still alive, basically, with his money. So I don't understand how this affected it so much.
It could be that it's not the estate because he put it in trust.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
So it could be that they have to go through him to the trust.
Usually you look at a person from where they are when the case starts, and they're not usually allowed to hide these assets or put them in trust once there are already what we'll call creditors, people suing them and have rightful claim to their money.
But you still have to go through all the legal shenanigans that it takes to pierce all that and get the money out of the trust.
And one thing that was very obvious throughout the documentary is none of these victims have settled and signed any confidentiality agreements against him because they were just laying it all out, saying whatever they would say. And these lawyers have really been fighting this case for years looking for the big payday at the end.
It started before he died. So
right.
All the,
oh, yeah,
it started
way before.
And I think bringing it full circle, the whole reason for the podcast, I mean, for the documentary was for the victims. Like you said, it was cathartic going before a judge, telling their story to the world in a documentary was probably cathartic for them.
So since we came full circle, I guess that's where we'll end it. Gina, thanks for coming on. It was
Anytime. Fun
to actually hear the questions audibly on the podcast instead of just via text. So hopefully everybody enjoyed this new way of doing it. and we'll be back with you guys next time.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.